Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the pantograph of Friday, May 1st, 2026. We begin first with page one, where the main story is about the Clinton Power Station, headlined Demystifying Nuclear Power. Constellation Energy raises awareness via open house. This story is Dateline Bloomington. Jess Clifford of Bloomington and her three young children visited the Clinton Power Station on Wednesday to learn more about what her husband Taylor does as an equipment manager for the plant. They wanted to come and see where Daddy works and what he does, which is kind of confusing, she said. Representatives of Constellation Energy, which owns and operates the nuclear power plant, were hoping to dispel some of the mysteries behind the plant operations with Wednesday's open house. Plant manager C.J. Smith said it's his hope to make these open houses an annual thing to communicate with constituents and community partners about the plant's successes. The Clinton Power Station uses heat from the nuclear core to turn water into steam that then passes through a set of turbines to generate electricity. In one room of the open house, attendees had the chance to put on a full set of protective clothing and equipment, which shield employees from radioactive particles and other contaminants. Nylon shoe covers are worn over the pant leg, and cotton glove liners are then worn under the sleeves. Coveralls that zip up to the neck are then put on over the nylon shoe covers, followed by a pair of rubber shoes. Another pair of special gloves go on, along with a hard hat, and specialized hood. Another room was set up for children to create their own atoms and molecules using edible modeling dough. However, many attendees gravitated to the plant's simulator, which is an exact replica of the facility's control room used for training purposes. The plant cannot be licensed without having a simulation program to make sure its operators are properly trained, according to Constellation Senior Operations Instructor Richard Tyler. Even after gaining licensure from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which usually takes between 18 and 24 months, operators must participate in ongoing training for 1 week out of every 5 weeks that they spend on shift operating the plant. This includes additional emergency training on the simulator. Engineers simulated a variety of different emergency situations, such as an earthquake and a SCRAM, which is a sudden shutdown of a nuclear reactor, most often triggered by the rapid insertion of control rods that absorb neutrons to slow fission in the reactor, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Tyler said situations like these are routine business for the plant's operators, and he has so much confidence that his farm is within 4 miles of the plant. I always tell these guys we're protecting not only the public, we're protecting my farm animals that I have and everything in all of our communities around, Tyler said. The plant is subject to numerous other safety inspections and audits. Two NRC resident inspectors are usually on site to conduct regular inspections, monitor plant operations and major work projects, and interact with employees and the public. Last year, Constellation entered into a 20-year power purchase agreement with tech and social media giant Meta, which will allow the plant to maintain operations through 2047 and expand its energy output by 30 megawatts. That is guaranteeing our power and guarantees us as a provider of power for the local communities and for the businesses that surround us, Smith said. As a result, Constellation would invest $370 million in state-of-the-art upgrades for the plant. The company said it has already invested more than $3 billion in its nuclear facilities in Illinois to ensure that they run safely and efficiently. Our next front page story is about gas prices, titled Global Market Hits U.S. at the Pump. Mideast War Impacts Oil Prices Everywhere. This is a story from USA Today. America is the world's leading oil producer. The United States is less reliant on foreign oil than at times in the past, and of the imported oil, only 8% comes from the Middle East. Why then have gasoline prices gone through the roof at America's pumps? U.S. gas prices spiked to an average of $4.18 a gallon on Tuesday, the highest level not just since the start of the Iran war, but since the early days of the Russia-Ukraine war in 2022. Gas prices are rising at a moment when peace talks between Iran and the United States seem to have stalled. In a speech to the nation on April 1st, President Donald Trump spoke of the Iran war and the contest for control of the Strait of Hormuz as if their outcome had little bearing on the market for oil and gasoline in the United States. The United States imports almost no oil through the Hormuz Strait and won't be taking any in the future, Trump said. We don't need it, we haven't needed it, and we don't need it. America produces more than 13 million barrels of crude oil a day as of January. More oil is exported than imported. But Americans also consume a lot of oil and import about 6 million barrels a day. Only a small fraction comes from the Persian Gulf. Based on those facts, it may seem as if a war in the Middle East would have no bearing on gas prices in the United States. It's a global market, said Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics. So oil literally flows to the highest price. If a tanker can get a higher price in Malaysia than it can in Rotterdam, than it can in Rio de Janeiro, it's going to go to Malaysia. And when the United States began airstrikes against Iran, oil prices spiked around the globe. By one benchmark, the West Texas Intermediate Index, crude oil prices rose from about $67 on February 27th to about $105 on March 30th. Oil prices rose because the Iran war crippled supply in the region. Between the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the sudden danger in shipping oil, and collateral damage to oil industry infrastructure, among other factors. War threatened the oil supply to regions that rely heavily on oil from the Middle East, including parts of Asia and Europe. Prices spiraled across the globe, including in the U.S. Everybody's competing for the same barrel of oil, said James Cox, managing partner at Harris Financial Group. It does not matter whether it's produced in Texas or Iran or Saudi Arabia or Russia. The United States is the top oil-producing nation on Earth, but it is also the top oil consumer, and America's oil producers are part of the global market. We produce as much as we consume, Zandi said. But at the end of the day, the producers here are going to sell to whoever can give them the highest prices as well. They are business people. The West Coast is particularly vulnerable to oil shocks in the Middle East because more of its oil comes from that region. That's one reason gas prices have soared to $5.93 a gallon in California, said Kate Gordon, CEO of California Forward, a nonprofit that advocates for sustainability. We get nothing from east of the Rockies, she said. California and the rest of the nation can take heart that the Iran war did not seed a gasoline shortage in the United States. There were long lines for gas, but they were populated mostly by people who wanted to save a few bucks at Costco. That is a far cry from the oil crisis of the 1970s, which triggered rationing, price controls, shortages, a national 55-mile-per-hour speed limit, and long lines at gas stations across the nation. For American consumers, economists say, the Iran war delivered more hardship than crisis. Motorists paid more for the gas that they purchased. Petroleum companies earned more for the oil they sold. Some other countries, more reliant on oil from the Middle East, introduced rationing, four-day work weeks, and remote work, and urged citizens to use less air conditioning and more public transportation. You could say the U.S. economy, on net, is somewhat insulated from the shock because we are such a large supplier, said Nikolai Rusinov, professor of finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, but that does not help the consumer at the pump. Gas prices have fluctuated in recent days, following news of a fragile ceasefire on April 8th. Even with a ceasefire, oil and gasoline prices will remain elevated for several months, Cox said, unless some new sources comes online. Insurance will rise on ships going through the strait, Zandi said. There's always a chance the ceasefire breaks, he said, and traders will want some premium to compensate for that risk. That premium is probably going to persist for some time, Cox said. He notes that oil futures, which speculate on prices at a future date, remain elevated through the end of 2026. Oil infrastructure in the Middle East has been damaged or disrupted in the Iran war. Some of it will take years and years to rebuild, Gordon said. And during that time, the world's oil supply will remain pinched. There's no going back to what we had, Zandi said, at least not this year. And our last front page story is about ISU. Headlined, Judge Rules Against Union in ISU Strike. This story is Dateline Bloomington. A McLean County judge has denied a temporary restraining order seeking to prevent Illinois State University from using outside contractors to supplement its workforce during the ongoing strike of AFSCME Local 1110 employees. Local 1110's roughly 350 building, grounds, and dining employees have been on strike since April 8th after negotiations for a new contract that have taken place over the last 10 months failed. The union has been without a pay increase for 2 years, and union leaders say their workers are among the lowest paid employees at ISU. In a letter to ISU President Andover Tarhul, the union identified 4 contractors who have been providing temporary replacement labor for the university during the strike, which is now in its 3rd week. AFSCME Council 31 filed a complaint alleging ISU's use of these contractors violates the Employment of Strike Breakers Act, which states no person shall knowingly employ any professional strike breaker in the place of an employee whose work has ceased as a direct consequence of a lockout or strike, or knowingly contract with a day and temporary labor service agency to provide a replacement for the employee during any period when a lockout or strike is in process. The statute defines a professional strike breaker as, quote, any person who repeatedly and habitually offers himself for employment on a temporary basis where a lockout or a strike exists to take the place of an employee whose work has ceased as a direct consequence of such lockout or strike, unquote. That person may be an individual, partnership, association, firm, corporation, union, or group of employees. In response to the lawsuit, the ISU defendants filed a motion to dismiss the case, which AFSCME Council 31 followed with a motion for a temporary restraining order preventing ISU from continuing to use outside contractors while the case is pending. McLean County Judge Rebecca Foley heard the union's motion during a virtual hearing on Wednesday. James Powers of Clark Baird Smith LLP in Rosemont, representing the ISU defendants, argued the Employment of Strike Breakers Act was intended solely to cover private sector employees, and in the 51 years since its enactment, his firm could not find any reported decisions that involved its application to a government entity like ISU. I think that's significant when you consider the fact that public employee strikes in Illinois have been legal since 1984 with the enactment of the Illinois Public Labor Relations Act and the Educational Labor Relations Act, Powers said. Powers also argued that if an established company with a permanent staff offers some of its employees to temporarily support another business, it does not automatically make that established company a day or temporary labor service agency under the law. Temporary labor service agencies are also required to register with the Illinois Department of Labor, and the contractors referenced in AFSCME Council 31's complaint do not appear on the list of registrants, he's added. If the Department of Labor does not consider them a day and temporary labor service agency, and the Department of Labor is the entity responsible for regulating this industry, How are we supposed to know? Powers asked. Stephanie Jokic, who represented AFSCME Council 31, argued, I'm sorry, Stephen Jokic, who represented AFSCME Council 31, argued the university acted as a corporation under the statute, and that definition should not be considered as private sector as a matter of statutory interpretation. Based upon the plain language of the terms that are used, which are intentionally broad, the type of thing that the university is doing in this case would fall within the reach of the statute, Jokic said. He also argued because of the large number of public employee strikes that occurred in the 1960s and 70s, it is likely lawmakers had considered labor unrest in the public sector at the time of the statute's passage. Foley determined that because it was illegal for employees of the state of Illinois and public universities to strike when the act was enacted in 1975, a corporation, as referenced in the statute, could not have referred to a public university like ISU. That definition was not changed, although it could have been with the 2004 amendment, Foley said. Had the legislature intended to include the state and/or a public university, it most certainly could have, both at the time of the original enactment or with any amendment. She also said, because a company may provide employees for a temporary term, that does not equate with or meet the definition of being in the business of supplying day and temporary labor. Therefore, Foley ruled against the union's motion and scheduled to hear the motion to dismiss AFSCME's initial complaint at a later date. AFSCME Council 31 spokesperson Anders Lindahl said that while the union disagrees with the decision, the judge made it clear that violations of the Employment of Strikebreakers Act are serious criminal offenses. Meanwhile, it's shockingly clear, as shown in the contracts we uncovered through FOIA, that ISU administration is paying huge sums for replacement workers and private company profits instead of simply addressing our concerns and settling a fair agreement, Lindahl said. According to a statement from the university, ISU has provided Local 1110 with three vendor contracts that total up to $116,800 in weekly expenses. It also notified that the union that contracted services are billed using fully loaded hourly rates that incorporate multiple cost components and that these rates should not be interpreted as the actual wages earned by employees of the vendor. And we turn now to some local and state news. This story is headlined, La Gondola Spaghetti House Plans to Close. Last day of business set for this Saturday, Vernon Street location to continue operations. This story is datelined Bloomington. A beloved Bloomington restaurant is closing its doors after 42 years in business. La Gondola Spaghetti House on South Main Street is closing its doors this weekend, but owners say they hope customers will continue patronizing their other La Gondola location in town. Owner Richard LaHood Jr. told the Pantograph his father started the family business all those years ago, and he was there the first day they opened the doors at 509 South Main Street in Bloomington. The family owns 10 restaurants throughout Illinois, also including the La Gondola location at 1501 East Vernon Avenue in Bloomington. And that Vernon location is going to stay open forever if I have my way. So I want to be expressively clear that we are not leaving Bloomington, LaHood said. And we're hopeful that our customers will still, drive across town and still visit our La Gondola there. We're hoping we can take really good care of them over there at our other Bloomington location, which incidentally has been there for 25 years. LaHood currently resides in Morton, but his wife manages the Main Street location, so they're in Bloomington almost every day. The Main Street restaurant's last day will be Saturday, May 2nd. The restaurant will open from 10:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. on its final day. Since announcing the closure, LaHood said they have had an outpouring of support at the Main Street location, but he encourages customers to head over to Vernon Avenue to continue supporting the family-owned business. He said this is the toughest decision they've ever had to make, but cited an uptick in petty crime and the subsequent strain on employees and the business as a reason for closing this location. LaHood said he hopes customers will understand and continue to show their support. It's beautiful to see this outsourcing of support. We love Bloomington. I lived in Bloomington myself for many years, and they're the greatest people. They're the greatest employees. They're also the greatest customers. In some ways, closing this store, this whole corner that I own, is one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, he said. And he said the support has been overwhelming. I'm not surprised, because Bloomington is just an amazing place to live and work and do business, LaHood said. He said he has the best employees in the world, too, and his goal is to continue to take great care of them, as they have taken care of the business for decades. The Vernon location will continue to operate 10:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. And in Livingston County, college student killed in crash. He played baseball for Lincoln Land College. Dateline, Dwight. A college student from Manuka has died after his vehicle crashed into the Mazon River in rural Livingston County, authorities said. About 6 a.m. Wednesday, Illinois State Police responded to the single vehicle scene south of North 2400 East Road near Dwight, according to a news release from Livingston County Coroner Michael Renner. State Police determined Michael T. Roberson, 20, was driving north on Old Route 66 when he crossed through the southbound lane and continued into the ditch on the west side of the road. The car traveled a couple hundred feet through a grassy area along the guardrail fence before reaching a concrete apron along the riverbank, and the car came to a stop in the river, flipped on its top, according to the news release. A passerby had called 911 after seeing the car in the water, Renner said. Roberson was traveling back to college at the time of the crash, which was believed to be in the early morning hours of Wednesday, according to the coroner's release. His cause of death is pending further examination, and toxicology testing is also pending. Roberson was a sophomore who played catcher for Lincoln Land Community College. In a Facebook post on Thursday, Lincoln Land's athletics department said, "Our heartfelt condolences go to his family, teammates, and friends." According to the post and the team's roster, Roberson previously played for John A. Logan College in Carterville, and he was a graduate of Providence Catholic in New Lenox. The crash remains under investigation by the Illinois State Police Troop 5 and the Livingston County Coroner's Office and the Livingston County Sheriff's Office, Dwight Fire Protection District, and EMS, and the Odell Fire Protection District also assisted at the scene. And a bovine breaks loose at the U of I. This story is datelined Urbana. A cow that took a jaunt across the University of Illinois campus Wednesday afternoon has been safely recovered and is receiving veterinary care, said Patrick Wade, Director of Executive Communications and Issues Management. The bovine got loose while being unloaded about 3:30 p.m. from a trailer at the College of Veterinary Medicine's large animal clinic. Personnel from VetMed, the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, and the Division of Public Safety followed the animal as it traveled through Mount Hope Cemetery south of campus and continued north toward campus grounds, ultimately resting near Follinger Auditorium, Wade said. He added that the cow sustained some superficial injuries, but is not expected to need additional treatment, and no people were seriously injured. We appreciate the quick and coordinated action of our campus teams in handling an unpredictable situation, Wade said. One Reddit user posted a video of the cow, joking that police officers were harassing it for trying to study at the main library. And Logan County offers well tests. Dateline Lincoln. The Logan County Department of Public Health has launched a new screening service for well water. The department will be offering coliform E. coli and nitrate screenings to homeowners that use well water. The Illinois Department of Public Health recommends testing well water at least once a year, according to a news release. Testing for coliform E. coli can tell residents if a water source is contaminated with infectious organisms, and nitrate sampling can help prevent illness in young children. All samples submitted must be collected with bottles provided by the health department. Samples can be submitted from 7:30 a.m. till 4 p.m. Monday through Thursday during regular work weeks. Tests cost $25 for the coliform E. coli and $5 for nitrates. And for more information on well water and resources, you can visit www.lcdph.org. And this story is headlined, MAHA Break Could Reshape Farm Bill and Midterms. This is a USA Today story, Dateline, Washington. Ahead of the midterm elections, the Make America Healthy Again movement that was key to President Donald Trump's return to the White House is causing friction within the Republican Party. The emerging political fracture is already jeopardizing critical pieces of legislation that farmers across the country are awaiting, and it could have larger consequences for the GOP's control of Congress. The evolving dynamic was on full display outside the Supreme Court Monday when a group of activists protested a case about shielding pesticide companies from cancer lawsuits. The justices appeared divided over whether Bayer, the manufacturer of the weed killer Roundup, should be protected from billions of dollars in potential liability. The Trump administration has backed Bayer in court, yielding pushback from notable MAHA figures. As activists rallied on the steps of the court, their debates mirrored ones that Republicans in Congress have been having for weeks on virtually the same issue. Rural lawmakers have been actively pushing to include a pro-pesticide provision in the upcoming farm bill. However, their more MAHA-oriented colleagues want no part of such an effort. Representative Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina, even introduced an amendment to strip what she calls the pesticide loophole from the legislation. South Carolina farmers, families, and communities deserve better, she posted on social media. Republican Representatives Thomas Massey of Kentucky, Anna Paulina Luna of Florida, and Chip Roy of Texas are among the other conservatives who are openly at odds with some of their other GOP colleagues. Luna said the farm bill must be stopped. I think Big Ag needs to be body checked, said Roy, who stressed the importance of warning labels for potential carcinogens and noted that he is a cancer survivor himself. That labeling issue is very real, he said. Several MAHA organizers said they have been discouraged with the state of their movement in a Republican-led Washington. Nora Kemmerer, a healthcare worker from Northern Virginia who was donning a red MAHA hat outside the Supreme Court, would not commit to voting for GOP candidates in November. We'll see what happens, she said. I don't know how I'm voting as of right now. I am frustrated. It is not the first time an effort to shield pesticide companies from liability has quietly shown up in important legislation this year. The same contentious provision drew outrage in January when it nearly derailed a government funding bill. Ultimately, opposition from MAHA activists killed it, until a few months later when it was included in the farm bill. Representative Glenn Thompson, Republican of Pennsylvania, the chair of the House Committee on Agriculture, has said new investment in American agriculture is overdue. During a congressional hearing Monday, he insisted the controversial section of the bill was not a liability shield. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, May 1st, 2026. I look forward to reading part two with you next.